Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of the Shuttlepod Podcast. I'm your host, Kaylee Iacovino, and today I'm joined by Matt Wright.
Hey, everybody.
And Jared Whitley.
Greetings.
This is Shuttlepod at the Disco, episode number 11, and today we are talking about Star Trek Discovery, episode number 12, titled Vaulting Ambition. This episode was written by Jordan Nardino, and it was directed by Hannah Lee Culpepper. So, guys, let's do our round the table quick reactions to the episode. Matt, what did you think of this week's episode of Star Trek Discovery?
I thought it was fine. It wasn't the best. I think the last episodes were better, but you know, it was okay.
How about you, Jared? Same reaction?
Same. The one, two episodes ago where we first start doing the Mirror Universe one, I think that's their best episode so far. And then last week, I thought was their second best episode. So, you know, everything can't be a winner. Not quite as enjoyable as the previous ones, no.
Yeah, I'm like in complete agreement with that. I totally agree. Two episodes ago, I think, was by far the best episode of the season. Last week's was also really, really stellar. And then this week's was, you know, I don't know. I would describe it as mediocre in a word, I guess. You know, it wasn't bad, but it's hard coming on the heels of those really two really strong episodes.
Yeah, I think it's got kind of middle child syndrome in a way. Like, here's this bridge to wrapping it up, you know, and like,
Act I'm two. Sure
that, yeah, and it's just, there you go, you know.
I will say, it, and I've said this a lot, I still think it was absolutely beautiful. The production values were incredible. We had so many cool different sets. I liked the scene when they were in the, this may be last week, when we see Stamets in the little spore universe. It kind of looked like it was from Avatar. Was that last week, mm-hmm. or was that this week?
Well, they show him there again. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah.
He's there talking to his mirror double again.
Yeah. So we have that. We have all the different sets from the Mirror Universe. We have the shots of the Emperor's flagship. So I mm-hmm. from a production value standpoint, again, it's just wonderful work that they're doing.
And, you know, I think I have to wonder if this episode suffers from something that I think last episode suffered a little bit from, which was the crux of this episode, like the meat of this episode, I think maybe not the meat, but the headline of this episode, I think, was the quote unquote twist at the end. And maybe, you know, I'm jumping ahead of myself a bit here, but you know, I think the headline of this episode is Lorca is from the Mirror Universe.
Mm-hmm. Right? Sure. Definitely.
And I think because certainly we were expecting it. I know people like us have gone and really dissected the show. And so we really have our heads in it. And so like none of the twists have been super twisty for us because we kind of saw most of them coming. And
sure.
I'm kind of getting the impression though, from people online, that a lot of people who are less have their heads less in the game, like compared to how we do, are also feeling this a similar way, and that the twists aren't shocking necessarily. And this episode and the last one, they seem to both play to this idea of this is just going to be so amazing. Like everything revolves around this twist. And like, as soon as you find this out, everything's going to click into place. And I think mm-hmm. in a number of ways it did, but in also a number of ways it didn't. And it doesn't quite like support the entire weight of the episode, I think. So I think the rest of the episode was sort of in service of this twist reveal. And while while it did shed some light on things that have come previously.
No pun intended.
Lorca's light sensitivity. That was the big one, right?
Yeah.
But I think it just didn't carry that weight of the full episode with it. So I don't know. I think mm-hmm. I wonder if it suffers a bit from that.
Yeah, there's a funny sketch from Robot Chicken, if you haven't seen it, from a number of years ago, with M. Night Shyamalan just like having, you know, just turning to the camera and like, oh, what a twist. And it's totally this. It's like, oh, we just hope it hinges on that. And you're like, oh, what a twist. You know, like, all right. You know what I mean? It's that kind of trope of like, well, we just hope this twist makes it amazing for you, right? It just works.
Yeah.
And whether, but you know, and it doesn't necessarily, you know, sort of paper over shortcomings, let's say.
And I think the last two episodes did a really good job of moving the plot forward quite a bit, especially two episodes ago, So that would be what, episode 10, and then episode 11 did so as well. And I feel like this one really didn't. The majority of plot development we got was with Stamets and Mira Stamets when he was like in the network. It felt like they moved that plot along, and other things barely moved at all. And when they did, it was either in an expected direction with Lorca or in a bit of a, what I found to be a strange direction with Laurel and Vok.
Yes. Agreed to that.
And before I move into, I know we're going to dive into each one of these things that I'm sort of alluding to here, but before we dive into that, I just want to point out that this episode was by far the shortest live action episode in the entire history of Star Trek at only 38 minutes long.
To be live action, just before any animated series folks jump in.
Except for TAS. The shortest episode in the history of Star Trek on television.
Yes. Has there been
commentary on that? On like why that was decision was made?
No, I don't think so. I don't think they're really talking about why it's short. No.
I was really shocked by this because as soon as the episode loaded on my CBS All Access app and I saw the timestamp going up to 38 minutes, I thought, oh no, something's wrong with CBS All Access. Me too. And that it didn't load the episode correctly or something. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yep. I had that worry for a minute and I was like, okay, that's all.
And then the episode ended and it felt short.
Oh, it did. It felt short. And we'll talk about this later, but I think it suffers for that, let's just say.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think that's the kind of thing that might have been an advantage in a less digital era where the idea of like cut, you know, you have a twist and then you cut off sooner than the audience is expecting could have an interesting effect. But if you've got a little task bar along the bottom that tells you exactly when it's going to end, it kind of negates some of that effect a little bit.
Yeah. Yeah, I could see that, I guess, being used as a shocking device to be like, you thought there was so much more, but we're just going to leave you with this twist. But, you know, it wasn't really effective here, I didn't think, if that was the intention.
Yeah.
All right. Well, why don't we start working our way through the episode then?
Let's do it.
I'd like to start with the Stamets storyline.
Sure.
Because I think that's what moved for me, what was developed the most in terms of plot.
Mm-hmm.
But I want to hear from you guys. What did you think about our journey with Stamets and Mira Stamets and Culber in the Mycelium Network?
Well, I think as far as things that weren't telegraphed, we didn't know anything of this. So it was, in that sense, it was one of the most interesting pieces.
Mm-hmm.
It's interesting to see that apparently Mira Stamets is, you know, sort of the R Stamets taken to a more ruthless bastard extreme, which is, of course, makes sense. Because R Stamets is kind of prickly, right? And kind of doesn't appear, and he appears to not care about people. But we know that's not true, of course, but he sort of appears that way. So, hey, what if that was really true? Oh, well, that's his mirror. You know, this guy doesn't give, you know, anything about anyone except for maybe his research. And it's interesting, of course, that in the beginning, Mira Stamets talks about this, you know, corruption, which I guess would really be a sickness almost because it's a fungal thing, a sickness sort of in the mycelial network. And what he kind of fails to tell him until later is, oh, yeah, he's actually the one that caused this problem. And certainly we had to have Culber addressed somehow. So this is how they chose to address his death. So we can talk about that too. I think it was a good way to do it.
Yeah, it was a nice eulogy, I guess. Is eulogy the right word? Or opportunity to say goodbye?
Yeah.
Sure.
And of course, Anthony Rappamulse and Cruz have great chemistry together. So that was like, those scenes were just like really great, right?
Yeah.
Those scenes were good. But
I thought what they did with Culber was really cool and giving, but I felt like they gave Stamets this opportunity to deal with the death of his partner in a way that no person ever really gets.
Oh, sure.
You know, he got to talk to him after he died and say goodbye. And I felt like they could have exploited that a bit more. I thought that Stamets didn't really take the time to digest what had happened. He accepted his death so quickly. Like, he learns of his death and then, you know, a couple sentences later, I think there's some line where Culber says, you know, how was your day? He's like, oh, it was pretty bad. Like, my partner just died. Ha ha. Mm. It's like, really, you've gotten there that quickly?
Well, I don't know. Stamets' personality in general, though. He's flippant like that, you know?
Sure. I don't know. I just felt like he moved through the grieving process a bit fast.
Well, he says that he's been aware that Culber died. It comes back to him that he held his body and stuff. I mean, initially he doesn't. And then it starts to dawn on him, oh, yeah, like, in my
I actually held you.
Yeah.
Yeah. So. And, you know, I do have to admit, though, as much as I'm complaining about it here, I am a bit relieved that they didn't draw it out because those are just, like, that's an emotion I don't necessarily need to feel.
Mm-hmm. Well, and the flip side is there is some urgency because there's that corruption. In fact, even this, you know, avatar of Hugh shows that, hey, look, I'm slowly, like, being corrupted, too. So Stamets can't totally dwell there. You know, there's this corruption that's happening.
So I have a thought about Culber because...
Let's hear it.
Culber presents Stamets with new information that he doesn't have. And really, the surroundings of the discovery and Culber, in effect, should be some kind of manifestation of Stamets' mind. So how does Culber have information about the network that Stamets does not?
Because Culber isn't really Culber. Culber's the network, remember? He's the manifestation network. At least that's what I assume.
That's exactly what I was thinking, too. Hmm. I was wondering if you guys had the same thought. Sounds like you did.
Oh, I did, yeah, for sure.
That can also be one of those things where, you know, the way intuition works is like your subconscious knows something that your conscious mind doesn't, and so it makes a little shortcut for you. So it could have just been a dramatized version of that.
Sure. Also a good point.
Thank you.
It'll be interesting to see going forward, you know, if Culber is really the personification of the network, then the network is communicating with Stamets in a very direct way, you know, using English.
Yes.
So,
well, at least he perceives it to be that way. You
know? Well, that's true. But he's communicating with him at a very advanced level. You know, it's not just with emotion or something. He's telling very specific things. So I think that's really interesting for, you know, any theories going forward as to, you know, what is the network in terms of, like, what kind of organism is it? Like, is it sentient? Those kinds of things. And then moral quandaries related to that. So it'll be interesting to see if they explore anything like that later. And of course, we know that, you know, going forward, they can't use this technology, right? We're all kind of waiting.
We all know that, yeah.
We're all waiting to find out, okay, well, why doesn't the Enterprise have a Spore Hub drive? Mm-hmm. So is it the corruption of the network?
Yeah.
Is it the fact that the navigator, like, goes crazy and...
I think it's probably going to be connected to the idea that it can open the door to parallel realities and that can cause problems.
Seems like it's all of the above.
Yeah, like, yeah.
You know, like, it requires almost the cost of nearly a human life, which no one is going to abide by, you know. And when it does, look what, you know, when it goes wrong, it goes very wrong and throws you into crazy places that you should never go. Mm. And so I don't know. We'll see.
But yeah, they got to do something with that, and they eventually.
Yeah, very soon, in fact, because there's only 3 episodes left.
Personally, I think they have to make it pretty clear, beyond saying, "Oh, there's some kind of ethical reason that we can't use the Spore Hub drive." Because if that were true, then certainly other factions or other species would not care about those ethical quandaries and decide to use it anyway.
Yeah.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah, that's something that's always struck me whenever we get to those episodes where the crew learns secrets man was not meant to know. I always think, okay, well, what about when the Romulans, the Cardassians, and the Ferengi stumble across this? They're just going to say, no, that's okay.
Yeah, and or humans that are not in the Federation.
Sure. Well, that's another good point. And that was actually something I kind of liked in Insurrection, is there's like these subspace weapons, and they say, every species has said these are unethical. Oh, wait, and now we're fighting somebody who doesn't care. So I like that they added that can still happen.
So I think we've come back to the fact that the network has to be like permanently corrupted for this to just end, right?
Because
otherwise... Yeah, it's just going to stick around somehow.
All right. So unless there's anything else on Stamets and Colbert.
Is this the last time we're going to see Colbert, do you think?
I hope not, but I'm not really sure how he fits in now, you know?
Well, you know, there's spoiler alert, maybe. If you don't watch After Trek, spoiler alert, that they, you know, it was hinted that he would return next season.
Yeah, they hinted that. I still don't know how that works, but yes, it was
hinted. I thought his return was just this stuff that they were doing here, but you're saying that it might be more extensive in the future.
Well, I think Wilson Cruz hopes that. I'm not sure that he's guaranteed anything beyond
this
return.
Good point.
They implied that might happen, that we might see him next season. So, I mean, but is he going to be just, you know, like a force ghost kind of thing like he is now? Or...
Yeah, he could be Stamets's, like, Jiminy Cricket kind of thing, you know? It's like... Because Stamets is kind of an unfeeling jerk, right? So it could have, Colbert could be like, oh, now Paul, you know?
Colbert is to Stamets as... Leah Brahms is to Geordi LaForge.
Oh no. Oh my.
It's just a holodeck simulation. It's a mycelial network simulation.
Every time you're touching the ship, you're touching me, Geordi.
Oh god, right. God. Here we go.
Every time we touch the network.
Yeah. Oh no. Okay, so
moving on. So that's the Stamets and Colbert storyline, which was fun. Oh, and just like real quick before we move on, just to mention that Mira Stamets has gotten out now, so he's free from the network thanks to our Stamets, and it seems to like have been implied that he might cause some havoc in the future, so maybe Mira Stamets will be back in next episode.
Okay, good to know. Good, something to watch for. It's kind of like George and Oscar Bluth from Arrested Development. They can always switch places of which one's in prison.
Oh, yeah.
yes.
Speaking of our of mirror people, I can't think of actually a good segue into this next one because they don't share any similarities. But let's move on to the Giorgio Burnham storyline, because there's really three storylines. There's Giorgio Burnham, Stamets, and then there's the Lorca storyline, which separates from Burnham's. So let's talk about Giorgio and Burnham, because this is a big chunk of this plot line as well. We learned a lot of new information about Mira Burnham's history, about Mira Giorgio's history and their relationship. What do you guys think about that? How did that play out for you?
There was nothing there that really surprised me. That's kind of what you presumed, that it would be this as a similar mentor protege type of relationship, but evil, of course.
Yeah, and the fact that, of course, Vulcans wouldn't raise her, so it makes perfect sense that they're really close in this sense. Like, that's her adopted daughter, not just you know, mentor,
right,
in this universe. Yeah, it made sense.
Also, something I like that they've shown in this. I guess Captain Tilly is where it started, is the whole idea of people having perhaps shorter lifespans due to murder in this universe, that everybody moves along in their career a little faster than they would normally. So Tilly's not a cadet, she's captain, and Giorgio's not captain, she's empress, because they, you know, we extrapolate that they've taken care of some people who may have been in the way of their ambitions.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
Was there some thoughts that you had on Giorgio Burnham, Kayla?
Kind of like what you said. It was, it made sense to me that they would have this, a similar relationship, like a mother-daughter thing. But it went even further, and it was interesting that they had Giorgio just calling her daughter directly, which is sort of this point that Giorgio and Burnham kind of had this unspoken, in our universe, Prime Universe, Giorgio and Burnham had this unspoken mother-daughter relationship. And now here Burnham is having to face this woman who she betrayed, and that betrayal ended up in her death. And she's having to, you know, she says, I think, to Lorca at the beginning of the episode, you know, it feels like a reckoning. So she's having to face that and looking at this woman who's calling her daughter. I thought that was interesting to me. I felt like that resonated a bit. So I thought that was nice that they did have her be the adopted daughter. I think it made it even harder for Burnham to have to deal with that.
Yeah, it's so great to see Michelle Yao back. I wish that the way they'd done this first season is like the first season was just her and Burnham having adventures the whole time, and then she didn't die till the end of the season instead of in the very first or second episode. I really would have preferred that.
Yes, that would have been awesome.
We need a prequel to this so badly.
Like, yeah.
Burnham and Giorgio, like, doing
a prequel to the prequel. Yeah,
and I was looking at Michelle Yeoh's resume on her on Wikipedia the other day, and she's, like, as a martial artist performer, has a resume that nobody else has, right? Because since she's, you know, a lady, she can be the opposite to so many male actors who have to be the protagonist, right? I mean, like, Jet Li and Jackie Chan never do stuff together, but she's done stuff with Jet Li and Jackie Chan and Ken Watanabe and Chow Yun-fat and Donnie Yen, right? And, oh, and James Bond, right? So she's got a resume that nobody else can touch. Yeah. And so to have her in Star Trek is delightful. To have her in just a little bit of Star Trek is a little sad.
I will say, though, I love her as the Emperor.
Oh, yeah, she's great. She's perfect as this kind of classically evil Empress.
Mm-hmm. I thought it was really interesting. I think it's kind of interesting to me, too, that I don't remember who said this, but that the costumes are a little Flash Gordon-y, you know, in the Mirror Universe.
Yeah, definite Ming the Merciless vibe.
Right, and so I think it's interesting. I wonder if they're conscious of this and sort of flipping this a little. That, of course, Giorgio is an Asian woman, which would sort of play into that old stereotype of Ming the Merciless.
Sure,
but it's
not. Yeah.
But it's not. I mean, the nice part is it's not, because she's not this ridiculous caricature. She's actually obviously like a woman of maybe twisted integrity, but integrity even in this version of the universe.
And of course,
honestly, I was just going to say, no one would mess with her. Like, if you look at her, I wouldn't mess with her. I mean, in any universe, honestly, she's someone to be respected. And it's just like, okay, this is great. Like, and I actually forgot that she's not super tall, because they have her on a platform for a lot of this episode. And then she finally steps down and addresses Michael kind of face to face. And of course, Nico Martin Green isn't all that tall either, actually. And so they're both not that tall, but honestly, like, doesn't matter. She projected this, you know, air of confidence as the Emperor that, like, oh yeah, like, you don't mess with her, you know. Yeah, she's actually kind of short, but
She's 5'4". Wow,
right, she's short, but man, you'd never know it, you know what I mean? Like, that's
her
not
presence
you...
is so
yeah that's not
bold.
What you get from her exactly. So yeah, even though she's like this kind of small woman, and she's surrounded by like huge, you know, dudes in that, you know, circle, like, nobody's gonna mess with her, obviously, considering the crazy death spinner fidget thing, like, that she no one's gonna mess with her.
I like that she had that. There's like a protocol in case someone mentions our universe. Mm-hmm. Right. And it kind of reminded me of the Voyager with the Omega particles. It's like they have this protocol for, you know, this super classified stuff. And of course, theirs is to murder everyone in the room, not just to make all the screens go black.
Yeah.
With an evil fidget spinner.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. But I mean, of course, they're going to be prepared for that kind of thing.
See, I kind of assumed it was like a snap decision. She was like, well, shit, now I have to kill you all.
She sounded like she was very well. She's well versed in our universe, thanks to the Defiant slipping back 100 years ago. I think this seems like a thing that she just knew she had to do now that it was brought up. Like, it was
right.
Seemed deliberate.
Right, but I guess I never considered that they had already predicted that this eventuality might occur and then come up with a protocol for it. Like, okay, so if someone mentions the Mirror Universe, make sure you kill them all. I thought she was just like, well, I guess I have to kill you all now because that's the only option.
Maybe, but it sure seemed like she was not fazed in the least to have this come up and was like, "Well, here we go."
Yeah,
it was gonna happen eventually, because the ship's been missing for 100 years from their universe, you know, or whatever.
That's true. Yeah.
Yeah.
Hey.
Yeah.
And then there's a similar scene in the first Deep Space Nine Mirror Universe episode with the evil Major Kira. It's not as lethal, but the same idea is we can't have this kind of nonsense being talked about.
Oh, yeah. Interesting. Nice.
You can't sow those seeds of equality. That's not going to work, you know.
Sure.
I can't have that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, do we want to talk a little bit about Lorca?
Oh, yes. Lots to talk about there, I think.
Yeah, there is a lot. We got to unpack that.
I think
that.
First we should talk about Lorca and Mirror Universe Burnham's relationship, because
I agree.
This is interesting, to say the least.
It was disconcerting.
Yes, it's not good. Well, I'll just get into it first, and you guys jump in after me. But this is what started to bother me about it, though, is that so Lorca apparently filled a, you know, missing father role, because Burnham, even though he had the, she had this very, you know, strong and present, at least the way Georgia talks about it, she was very present as a, like, figure, you know, authority figure and mother figure for Burnham. Even with all of that, somehow she was missing her, a daddy figure, and Lorca filled that role. And then the worst, that's kind of stereotypical and not necessarily true to life. But even worse than that is the really gross kind of trope where the father figure eventually turns into a lover. And it's like, oh no, did you really need to go there with that? Did we need to do this?
See,
that's a really gross thing to do.
See, my theory with that, though, is it fits with how we've, you know, through ever since the first episode with the Mirror Mirror, we've seen that this is an evil universe where there's a lot of sexual exploitation. And Seinfeld, it kind of just went along with that.
It sure, and that's a good point. But it's still just interesting because, I don't know, man. The way they talk about it, it's less about, like, exploitation, like, for your career ladder, and more creepy. Lorca
like
took a
like
liking
love.
To young Burnham. Yeah, Lorca took a liking to young Burnham, and eventually Burnham sort of returns it. And that's interesting and not so
yeah,
great.
Yeah, I didn't like it. That was weird.
Unnecessary.
Yeah,
unnecessary. There's no reason why Lorca couldn't, because, you know, this whole thing where, okay, so he's you know, he'll go to the ends of the universe and beyond, since he's switching universes, like, to find her. That's honestly, like, Lorca's a driven guy anyway. That could literally be because he needs Burnham Prime to fulfill his mission. He's that driven anyway. We've seen him not driven about things anyway. It doesn't have to be because he's got a bizarre, you know, relationship going on with, you know,
and
it doesn't have to be.
And they could have stopped at father figure.
Exactly. They could have stopped there, because people, you know, that's understandable.
Or just mentor. It doesn't have to be father figure. There's no reason that a male mentor has to take the place of a father.
And that's the part that bothers me more than anything, is that that's an assumption that, by the way, is not necessarily borne out. If you guys don't know, I'm also a sociologist, so I can tell you it's not always borne out of truth, you know, in reality, that you have this need that, oh yeah, a single mother doesn't fulfill everything, right? There's this unspoken assumption that specifically you better have a father figure around.
Yeah, you need one mother and one father.
Right, and that, for example, a single parent can't maybe fill both roles somehow, which is absolutely not true. Mm-hmm. I mean, certainly we see that there are problems with that sometimes, but that's not a given. You know what I mean? That's not a be all end all. People aren't doomed because they're missing one parent.
Well, and you can, and you can have multiple mentors
absolutely.
That aren't necessarily a parental figure.
Absolutely. There's no requirement for this.
They could have just said that he was some mentor to her.
Right.
And so
just,
he cared
just
deep
like
for
Giorgio,
her in that way.
Right, just like Giorgio in the Prime Universe was a very close, like, mentor to Burnham. But nope, not her mom. Didn't adopt her. You know what I mean? Like, we don't have to assume this.
Right,
you know what I mean? They don't have to make it that way. Anyway, so that really, the more I reflected on it, the more that bothered me.
Interesting insights.
So let's explore Lorca's path a bit. Because we learn this about his relationship to Burnham. And, of course, upon learning the big reveal that he is indeed from the Mirror Universe, like, a lot of things, including that which we just learned, starts to make sense. So we recently wrote an article on Trek Movie before this episode came out about a fan theory that was going around that was that Lorca is from the Mirror Universe. So a lot of people had caught on to this already. People were talking about it on the internet. And we broke down a lot of the evidence for that theory. And one of the cool things in writing that article was that I got to go back and remind myself about all of these little details, and a lot of them I didn't even make into the article. It's like really small details that were foreshadowing to this moment. It's another issue whether you think that that is fun and leads to like a fun quote unquote twist, or just like a fun story. And some people, I guess, would also consider that to be bad writing if we're able to anticipate every one of these twists. So there's definitely, you know, I think people feeling both ways, people who have anticipated all the twists, I think have been less happy with the amount of foreshadowing. But in a lot of ways, there are things I like about it, because there are definitely pieces like the light sensitivity. I should have gotten that sooner than I did. Like, other people pointed out to me the foreshadowing about Lorca's light sensitivity. And the big one was a few episodes ago when they end up in the mirror universe. I think it's Burnham doing one of her like logs, says something about, I think it's Burnham who says, you know, even the light here is different.
Yeah, oh, interesting. Interesting.
And that was the moment for all. Yeah, me neither. And that was the moment for a lot of people when they went, he's from the mirror universe. The light is different. Yep. He has the light thing.
Yep. That was the clincher for sure.
For a lot of people, it was. For me, I think it was just before that, in the episode prior or before they end up in the mirror universe, where Lorca very obviously manipulates the spore jump.
Oh, yeah. His manipulation of Stamets is like, you know, epic, basically. It's quite amazing.
He manipulates Stamets, and then you see him pull up on his console. He goes to the navigational array, and you see it written right on the screen. It says, override Lorca G. And then it's showing all the coordinates from the previous jumps. And then for this next jump, it says, under coordinates, it says unknown. And then they end up in the mirror universe. So from there, it was pretty clear that, you know, he did that on purpose. And like, putting all the pieces together, we're like, yeah, it really seems like he's mirror universe Lorca. Huh. You know, ever since, you know, we saw that scene, those scenes with him and Admiral Cornwell, where she says to him, you know, ever since the Baran, it's like you're a different person. Like, because maybe literally he is. You know, he's skeptical of everyone. He's carrying around, he's like sleeping with a phaser. You know, he's protecting himself in that way. And a lot of his ideals that we've seen him express aren't really the ideals of Starfleet. You know, he's driven by, and he's so good at war. How does he know so much about war and strategizing when he comes from Starfleet, and when his lifetime they've been almost entirely in peacetime? And so how does he know so much about war strategy, and why is he so obsessed with weapons and these kinds of things? And so there's so many like, little things that they dropped in that once you realize he's from the mirror universe,
it all tends
to click in. Yeah. What were there any big things for you that, like, particularly for this Lorca, I'm going to put twist in quotes continually, quote unquote twist that was like, oh, that clicks with this moment for me?
The only other little thing that I noticed is, remember we were all remarking that. The very first mirror episode, when Tyler was out in the work bee and had his little like PTSD moment, and Burnham was like talking him down and kind of, you know, unofficially talking him down, and then Lorca notices and basically slaps that down annoyingly. You know, this idea that he was actually like in a real, you know, in love with Burnham actually kind of adds a new level of, oh, no wonder why he's pissed that like Burnham's, you know, kind of talking lovingly to Tyler, he's mad that she's in a relationship, because of course in theory they're lovers, you know, to him in his universe. So it adds another like layer of why he's so annoyed about it.
Oh, okay, yeah, that makes sense.
Mm-hmm. Just a little thing.
Yeah, good observation. It's really making me feel like I paid better attention to this the second half of the season.
I think for me it's because I've been, especially for writing this fan theory mirror universe article, I really got to go back, like I had to go back and look at all the details and you know, get screen caps and stuff. I didn't realize how obvious it was, for example, that he navigated to the navigational array on his little console before the Spore jump to the mirror universe. And it's like right there. It says like, it basically says Lorca just overrided the jump.
They made it very clear. Yeah.
Yeah. But there's a lot of those things peppered in. I like that. Some people have said that they think it's too much, but I think it's cool actually for the most part.
I think it's good. Yeah.
And, you know, they've done this a couple times this season, and I think they've done it really well every time they've done it, is they've added to canon in a way that's very difficult to do, I think. To do it well and to make it fit. Okay. And of course, I'm talking about the light sensitivity thing. That's new that, and anyone from the mirror universe has a sensitivity to light, and that is the main thing that separates them, you know, biologically.
Yeah, and I was thinking about that too. Is like pretty much every Mirror Universe episode is pretty dark. Like the lighting levels are low, and I was like, "Hey, that actually pretty much works."
Yeah,
you mostly can't. Aside from Mirror, the original series, the original lighting was essentially the same.
Yeah,
but the Deus Ex 9 episodes, everything's pretty murky. You know, everything's pretty dark in those. And of course, Enterprise again, it's pretty moody. It's pretty dark in those.
Yep.
So I'm thinking like, "Hey, that pretty much works." Mm-hmm. Nice. You know, like,
yeah, I got to give a hat tip to them on that one. I thought it was pretty clever.
Yeah.
And I thought another like side note here, another interesting thing that I think is new to canon is that these giant ships in the Mirror Universe are powered by what looks like a small sun.
Hmm. Yeah.
So like the Palace ship. So.
That Palace ship totally has a small like star in its center. Yeah.
So
the one thing that was pointed out, I saw a commenter point out, and I was reminded and went, "Oh duh, I knew that." Is that's new for the like the Terran/Federation side, but actually in TNG we learned that
that's Romulans, what the Romulans do. Yeah.
Yeah.
Quantum harness singularity.
A small singularity.
Well, they use a singularity, which is similar but not the same as a star.
It's like an imploded sun or something.
It's a black hole. Singularity.
It's close.
Yeah.
It's close. It's a cousin of sorts.
But not every star would turn into a black hole.
That's very true.
But yeah, I actually thought of the same thing, that it's a similar idea. Is there?
Yeah, it's not the same, but it's similar. And of course, we've never seen just a massive like state ship powered by something like that before ever.
Yeah.
It's pretty cool. Yeah.
Like it's like a fusion drive, I guess.
Mm, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I guess it would be. Yeah.
So that was pretty neat.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, what's next? We want to talk about Kelpien.
Sure, that's an interesting little aside in the Mirror Universe. These poor Kelpians, huh?
Yeah, because Saru makes the comment that there aren't many of my kind in this universe. And you're like, oh, okay, yeah, because, you know, he's prey and this is a world of predators or whatever. And then that we see that they're a delicacy. That was kind of hard.
Yeah, that was rough.
Yeah, that was unsettling.
Yeah. Poor Burnham thought she was just getting like another slave to serve her, and no, not quite to serve her. Served to her.
Yeah. she had Saru for dinner.
To be clear, that was not Saru. People have sort of been mistaken, but let's just be clear, that actually wasn't Saru, another Kelpien. Saru was still back on the Shenzo waiting to bathe her.
Wait, what's it? Was it played by Doug Jones?
No, the problem is all, you know, the Kelpians are all tall, gangly looking thing, you know, mm-hmm. creatures. And a lot of people thought, a lot of people thought that. And for a split second, I did too. And I was like, well, no, that's not possible. A lot of people thought that she picked Saru from a lineup to like save him. She thought she was like saving him.
Yeah.
And somehow it's not. Of course, the author of the writer of the episode even said so. And also, it's just not like that. It wouldn't make any sense. We know Saru didn't like come on the shuttle with them to the Emperor's ship.
Sure.
I thought it was Saru too, and I feel dumb now.
So I think my hunch is this is just totally like not, you know, there's no validation of this, but I have a hunch like it's probably Doug Jones's like stunt double or something. That's why it looks so much like him.
Interesting.
Well, they could have made the face more different, because the other two looked really different.
Were a little fatter looking or something, you know, chubbier in the face or something. They're a little bit different. Yeah, I wish they had made it a little more clear too. But no,
because there were three Kelpians, and I thought they looked distinct. Why would they have to pick the one that looks exactly like Saru?
Yeah, I agree. I think that was a mistake. but or they thought they were being a little more clever than they really were. Just like they thought you were supposed to think it was through for a second.
But that's,
you know,
just confusing.
Right. And of course now they've had to take to Twitter and say, no, it wasn't Saru. Like, no, don't worry. Like, that's not what happened. And it's like, okay. No.
I would just like to take this moment to point out that we have now been recording this podcast for longer than the runtime of the actual episode.
Oh. Ouch. Oh, take that, 38 minutes.
Yeah. So, you know what we haven't talked about yet? And let's, I think we need to talk about this, is the... Well, I keep saying how many storylines there were and then adding another. I think this is the fourth storyline in this episode.
Yes.
Which is the Laurel / Vokler / Prime Saru storyline. And it's short, but it's important.
Perhaps too short.
Yeah, you know what? If there was a place that they were going to extend this episode, I'd like it to be between Laurel and Vokler, that whole thing. Because I think the scenes leading up to it with Saru negotiating, if you will, with Laurel while she's in the brig, I thought those were great. And I liked how they were sort of, you kind of came back to them a couple of times and then they resolved it. I thought those were great. I thought Saru in his first couple of interactions with Laurel almost reminded me of the way that Picard sometimes, diplomatically negotiates with people, the way the sort of tactics he was using when speaking to her. Of course, then he gets a little more cutthroat and just beams Vokler right into the brig with her in order to get her to sort of break. I liked those scenes, and I thought the just watching, Doug Jones and Mary Chifo, I thought was really entertaining. Yeah. I liked the two of them on screen.
Again, two really great actors that do amazing things through prosthetics too.
My main takeaway from this exchange, this storyline, is how glad I was to have not had to hear Klingon for the last couple episodes. Man, those scenes were so hard to get through.
Yeah, they were. And we had a little bit, but it wasn't like you had to follow huge swaths of dialogue.
Yeah. Yeah, it's like those scenes reminded me, maybe I already said this, it's like the Star Wars Holiday Special, there are these scenes with all Wookiees, and they're just growling at each other for like 10 minutes at a time. And there's no subtitles, so it's actually, I don't know which one is better or worse, but I'm so glad that if they had to bring back Klingon, it's just for a couple lines.
It is fun to hear them speak it. Because they've really paid so much attention in this series to pronouncing it, quote unquote, correctly, working with people who speak the Klingon language. So, like Kalesh and things like that. So, I don't know. It's cool to hear him speak it, but I totally agree with you. It's hard to follow those. Like, the first couple episodes were way too heavy on that.
Way too much.
Yeah.
Way too much.
Peppered throughout would have been good. But...
It's like balsamic vinaigrette. You put a little bit on the salad, you don't drink a bowl of it.
A little goes a long way.
Yeah. Anyway.
But let's talk about the maybe most important part of this episode, the storyline for this episode, which was like 2 seconds, which was Laurel says, okay, you've convinced me. I can help him. We can help him, but only at my hand. And then cut to Laurel in the sick bay wearing some weird glove thing. And like, side note, did she bring her own mind altering glove with her?
Yeah, and when would she have done that? Because she leapt at Tyler and jumped in the transporter beam at the last second.
Yeah. So, or did they does Starfleet have its own mind altering Klingon glove technology? Like, just like waiting.
well, they do now.
Right. Yeah, I guess so. They've learned the House Mokai secrets. Thanks a lot, Laurel, for spilling those beans. So now she's like giving some kind of evil Klingon scalp massage to Vokler, who then, I guess, it's Vox, but I skipped ahead of myself, right? First, she monologues, which is what no villain should ever do.
No.
Right? When they just explain the entire plot of their deception.
Yeah.
So she explains, like, this is exactly what we did. We took Vox's body and we crushed it. We formed it into Tyler's body. And Tyler was this prisoner of war. And we took his consciousness and they put it into this thing. We did this thing. Okay, now skip ahead to scalp massage. We're de-Vocking him. But it's Vox's body. And so she killed Vok, right? Because she does the Klingon death howl.
Yeah.
And so now she's killed the original inhabitant of this body. And what is actually in there? Is it like a real consciousness or is it just this like implant copy? Like what? I was confused and surprised by that. And I feel like if this is really the end of Vok, that it's like the most disappointing way they could have possibly ended his storyline.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. I agree.
I agree with that completely. Yeah. It's too abrupt.
It's very hasty, like, hey, we're almost done here. We better just do something about this. And, of course, like, we want to keep Shazad Latif around, so we better leave him as Tyler. Okay, done. You know what I mean? Like
I approve of keeping Shazad Latif around. But
me too, of course.
They've been stringing... he's amazing. But they've been stringing us along this whole season about, like, Vok was from episode one. Mm-hmm. You know, Vok is the guy to look for. We're at war with the Klingons. Apparently, even though we never really get to see that, but Vok is supposed to be like, you know, you imagine there's going to be this long arc where we come back around to the war and Vok has something and Laurel is doing something, but now he's just dead and gone, so that's the end of Vok. So it feels like the whole half of this first season is like, well, forget about Vok because he actually didn't matter in the end.
Right. Yeah, it's very it doesn't make a lot of sense. The only sense I can see, I think, and again, this goes back to the episode is short. They could have written more.
Right.
With Laurel. They could have written more with Laurel. It really wouldn't have been hard for... I thought of these like lines last night. It wouldn't be hard for her to go into sickbay, look at him one last time, and say something very, you know, dramatic and very kind of Klingon-y about that, you know, these eyes that look back at her are no longer Vox. So that's who she should kill. You know what I mean? You say something very dramatic like that, she goes, look, this is Tyler now. Like, you know, this person that I once, you know, thought I revered is gone. And then you zap him and like, there's a little more to it. You know what I mean? There's a little more heft to it. It's a little more exposition, but not in a bad way. Like there was exposition that was actually needed.
I agree.
A little more. Now I don't know if they're like trying to be cute and like hold this for a beat, you know, hold this until next week and then it's all gonna be, but it really, I think it was a disservice to this episode then if that's what they're doing. You know, if they're like, well, we think we're gonna sort of imply that it was Vok, but we won't tell you until next week, it's like, okay, I guess
yeah,
you know,
why like, keep oh, it why? Like a secret, just come out and why? Say it.
Yeah. And so I guess the only thing with Vok is that he had sort of failed at his mission because this is that whole Tyler is surfacing more than they expected and fighting back, you know, his consciousness is fighting back more than they expected because of love for Burnham, blob, you know, puke kind of thing. But because it's kind of silly, it's a little fairy tale-ish, you know, like the love of Burnham is keeping, you know, one consciousness over the other sort of. But okay, so all that's true, so then she considers Vok to have just sort of failed at his mission, and I guess it's supposed to be a mercy killing of sorts, you know, so he can go to Stovakor, which of course is why she then ends up doing the you know, the Klingon death scream to warn, you know, to warn the warriors of Stovakor that another one's coming, that kind of
thing.
But honestly, is this an honorable... This is a little aside that I was thinking about. Is this an honorable death to Klingons? I'm not really sure it is at this point.
He died in service of the war effort. On the one hand,
he did, but also like he let himself be bastardized. Like this is a guy with a purity, right?
Yeah.
But in the name of it all, he let himself be totally bastardized into the enemy. Like he got himself turned completely into a human, right? So it's weird. Like I don't know. Does he earn a place up there? I don't know. But anyway, so I guess she thinks that anyway, and kills Vok in a, you know, sort of a Klingon honor killing, I guess, is the way to look at it. Again, they needed, if they just said that, she should have just walked up to him and said, like, you know, the eyes look back at me like aren't Vok's anymore. You know, Vok has, you know, done, you know, tried to do what he needed to do for the cause, whatever, blah, blah, blah. And then just say, like, all right, it's time to let him go honorably to Stovacor. And then do the, you know, crazy scalp massage zapping. This is one of those times where I feel like a little soliloquy was good and was needed, you know.
Yeah.
And, you know, Laurel's a good character for it. So it should have, I don't know. It's weird. I think it's really weird. It's all very hasty. And it shouldn't have been.
Yeah, I agree. Well, the main reason I guess I'm anxious for the next episode is to find out, like, if they're going to do more with this, because I felt like they just left it laying there.
They did.
And it's hard for me to think that that's how they're going to end the Vox storyline.
Yeah.
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 You know, weird. We had a really great article about what to do with the Vox, you know, that was, of course, written before this episode. And as they... As it's pointed out in that article, one of the most, you know, Trek things to do is somehow fuse the two of them and let them learn to live together.
Like a Tuvix kind of thing?
Like Tuvix, yeah.
Let these two personalities, like, meld and come to some kind of new, because he's no longer Tyler Norvoke, right? He's sort of both, this new sort of person. And... you know, show that struggle, right? Well, of course, the season's almost over. They don't have time to show it anymore. But it would be much more of a, you know, Trek thing to have Laurel pull out MacGuffin that, because she's already got her little MacGuffin, but that MacGuffin then sort of somehow fuses the two in a meaningful way instead of kills one. You know what I mean?
At least have them discuss that. At least have them talk about the morality.
Exactly. Again, 38 minutes long. They had time to put in this kind of dialogue. They really did.
If they wanted to end it, they could. If they really wanted to say, we don't want to end up with a fused person, we want one or the other, you know, and we want Tyler, they could still do that, because they could go through the discussion, you know, and point out the morality and talk about, and then have Laurel say, like, look, we can't, like, Vok is too far gone. And if we don't just end the Vok part, like, they'll both die, you know, anything.
Right. Or the whole thing of, like, Vok is so, stodgy and stodgy, what's the word? Vok is so, you know, prejudiced and so just strictly like a Klingon,
single-minded,
you know, Klingons, Klingon. Yes, thank you. Single-minded. That's a word. That'll work. He's so single-minded about, you know, this keeping Klingons, you know, Klingons pure and, you know, looking for, you know, following into Kuvma's footsteps that, yeah, he would, you know, the Vok consciousness would never put up with being in what's now a human's body, right?
Yeah. So there's this episode of TNG. I totally cut you off.
I was just going to say, you could, again, that's things you could throw out there. You know what I mean? You could throw this kind of dialogue out there and at least it would help. That's all.
So the thing I was going to say is there's this episode of TNG where Riker gets the powers of the Q, right? And he gives Riker some lemonade and he gives Worf some lemonade or wine or something together, and Worf just pours it out. And Q says, "Drink not with thine enemies, the rigid Klingon code." And, like, what could be a more violation of that code than what's going on right now with this character?
Right, exactly. So again, you say cite the Klingon proverb or whatever. You say that and you go, okay, that's why Vok has to die. He would refuse to work, you know, in this together.
I thought that would be interesting. Yeah, that would be an interesting way to explore the Klingon culture a bit more too, not only for Trekkies but for people who are, like, less familiar with that history. I think it would drive that point home. About, you know, this remain Klingon thing isn't just entirely fabricated for this series, you know, that there are reasons that part of their culture goes back, like, throughout more of sort of Trek history. So, yeah, that could have been a really interesting way to do it.
Oh, here's my question. I guess I just want to ask, do we think that Lorca will die by the end of the season?
Oh,
good question.
Oh, yeah. I think the more general question is, do we think that... Lorca will be back for season two.
Yeah, that which is what I mean, right?
I want him to be back, but I think that maybe I wouldn't be surprised if an actor of this caliber were only in it for one season. You know what I mean? Because he's a movie star, and, you know, why is he doing Star Trek?
thing is, with like a shorter season, though, you can still have a movie career. I think that's one of the reasons for these like 10 to 14 prestige format dramas, is that it, episode per year dramas, is that it gives the creative staff a little bit more flexibility in their schedule than if they have to do 20 to 25 episodes.
Yeah. I just don't see how he stays.
It seems impossible. How could he?
Yeah.
Given what's happened.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Especially since he still has some plan to execute in the Mirror Universe. He's still up to something that he hasn't completed yet. We don't know what that is.
But if he's anti-Emperor Giorgio, then doesn't that imply that he has some ideals that mirror like the Federation?
No. The part you're missing is he wants to be emperor. He wants to assassinate her.
Yeah, that would be the difference.
It's he doesn't have any ideals. He wants
That's the thing.
It's like
that sucks though, because I like him.
Yeah, me too. He's my favorite character.
Jason Isaacs is really great. I mean, I don't know. We shall see.
So, but it sounds like we're pretty much voting. We doubt he's gonna make it to next season.
I just don't see how. Yeah, I just don't see how.
Yeah, that sucks.
So I think we end up with Captain Saru and reinstated Burnham as his like second officer.
But who,
I just don't know
how who can really be captain? If they make Saru captain, I'll be kind of upset, because
it would be weird.
It would be a terrible decision. Well, Saru's already shown his capacity, his inability to lead. I'm sorry, but his thing on that planet, that when he had that freak out on the planet.
Yeah.
And then at the end of the episode, they said, oh, by the way, he wasn't under the influence of, you know, magic spores or anything like that. That was actually Saru acting as himself. That is when I said, okay, well, now that we know that he cannot handle like any kind of stressful situation. And if he even gets tempted a little bit, then he will resort to killing his fellow officers. So not someone who I want to have as my captain.
Yeah.
And then of course everything since then has sort of ignored that, I feel like, and shown that he's a competent guy.
But I think it's a pretty big deal.
Yeah.
They put that out there on purpose. You got to keep it.
Yeah.
It's also a sign that episode wasn't what it could have been. Right. I mean, as Brian said, there was a great episode of Star Trek in there somewhere, but we didn't
get it. There was. There was. It was really trying to get out, and it wasn't allowed to.
Anyway, well, there we go. What do you think? Be sure to put it in the comment section below, or tweet us at Trek Movie. Sorry. Anyway.
As always. Well done, Jared. Way to wrap us up. I think I was just going to say that, you know, we've already talked for much longer. That it would have been shorter. You know, why are you even listening to this podcast? It would have been shorter to just go watch the episode again. We could have just played the episode.
Yeah. We could have just done a riff tracks over the episode.
You know what? Maybe I'd love to do that one day, actually. Is do Trek movie commentaries.
Yeah, that would be good. I think there could be a market for that.
I think so, too. Like, you know, us and our friends and our moms.
Oh, okay. Here, let me add this. I haven't done a Trek anecdote for a while, but I was actually watching the riff tracks for Indiana Jones and the Kingdom of the Crystal Skull. And,
oh, wow.
And when the Cate Blanchett evil Russian character comes out, you know, she's got that really severe, like, bowl cut. And one of the robots sees her and he says, hey, it's a Romulan. And because, you know, she kind of looks like one. Anyway, I thought it was funny.
So they say that on the riff tracks?
Yeah, they say that on the riff tracks. So
that's awesome.
Cute little Star Trek reference.
Nice. Nice. Oh, man. Feels like the good old days with Jared and his Trek anecdotes.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, thank you. Hopefully there'll be some good future days very soon.
All right, guys. So I think that about does it for episode 12, Ulting Ambition, Star Trek Discovery. Stick around next week to find out, now that we know that Lorca is Mirror Lorca, where do we go from here? What happened to Vok and Tyler? Is he just Tyler now? Will he just go on as Tyler and just be Tyler and be on the crew? That's kind of weird. We'll find out next week on Star Trek Discovery episode number 13, What's Past is Prologue. See you next week, guys.
Take care.
Bye, guys.